Welcome to another action-packed installment of Whiskey and IR Theory, the podcast where the hosts pair a whiskey with a classic work of IR Theory, drink that whiskey, and talk about the work of IR Theory until they are drunk and you are bored. Yeah, that sounds about right. If you're not terribly familiar with what we do here, you might not know that we actually have two types of episodes. We have the modal episode, which is what I just described, but we also have something that we call whiskey optional. In a whiskey optional episode, there is no whiskey pairing. There is no mandatory drinkage. Instead, we put together a panel of people to discuss a topic or a subject or a controversy pertaining to international relations theory. This is a whiskey optional episode. The subject is international hierarchy. The participants are David Lake of the University of California at San Diego, Danny Nadal of the University of Toronto, and Aish Zarikol of the University of Cambridge. And then there's me, Dan Nexon. So normally at this point I'd say, yeah, let's get on with it, or without further ado, let's listen to our panel, or let's cut to the audio tape, or something like that. But I think this time I want to say a few words about what we mean when we talk about international hierarchy. In recent years, we've seen the rise of what Janice and Aisha call hierarchy-centric scholarship, what, as I may have mentioned before, I call the new hierarchy studies. And this is work that says, well, you know, for a long time, we have thought that international politics is characterized by the condition of anarchy, the lack of a common authority to make and enforce disputes, or, if you will, the lack of a world government. And this is supposed to have implications in realist theory. It means that authority, to paraphrase Rawls, quickly reduces to capabilities. The strong do what they will, the weak do what they must. It means that the system is a self-help system. So that's where you get notions like balance of power predominates, and so on and so forth. So in general, when we talk about hierarchy, we would say something like social and political systems are hierarchical to the extent that they are stratified along a series of asymmetric rankings or positions. That is, hierarchy refers to any pattern of super insubordination. Status hierarchies are stratified by rankings of honor and prestige, class hierarchies by economic roles, and so on and so forth. These stratifications matter to the extent that they translate into relations and practices of social dominance. Much of IR scholarship, from work on global governance to theories of great power politics, examines the cause and consequences of various forms of super insubordination, but critically, it wasn't seen that way, or it often wasn't treated that way. Major research programs, hegemonic stability theory, power transition theory, world systems theory, dependency theory, the study of empires, take some kind of international hierarchy as a basic fact of world politics, but by the 1990s, the focus of theoretical debates in the field generally shifted to the nature and consequences of international anarchy. This change owed much to the emergence of structural realism as a focal point of theoretical debates. For structural realists, anarchy represents not only the central fact of world politics, but also the reason why we can talk about international relations as a distinctive area of inquiry where politics has its own different dynamics from those you would find within domestic politics. In Waltz's formulation, parts of domestic political systems stand in relations of super insubordination. Some are entitled to command. Others are required to obey. Domestic systems are centralized and hierarchic. In contrast, the parts of international political systems stand in relations of coordination. Formally, each is the equal of all the others. None is entitled to command. None is required to obey. International relations are decentralized and anarchic. Indeed, if you take an international relations course, like an Intro 1 as an undergraduate, this is probably the story you've heard. And this is probably you've learned about anarchy early on. You've learned about how that makes international relations distinctive. So if we switch to hierarchy, the argument goes, we need to abandon at least some of these assumptions. We can start using theories that we would associate with domestic politics to explain things in international relations. I would argue the opposite is also true, that we can use international relations theories to talk about domestic politics. We already do both. We just don't kind of think why we might be able to do so. This is an area that I work on. I'm sure we will read other pieces on hierarchy in the future. If you want to know more about anarchy, you can listen to the first two podcasts we did, the very first two, which were on Waltz's theory of international politics, or you can listen to the two that we did more recently on Mearsheimer's The False Promise of International Institutions, which is a different but related statement about the implications of anarchy. Okay, now without further ado, let's go to the audio tape. Just so our audience can know what you sound like and put a name to your voices, I think it would be a good idea if I just, you know, went around and called your name and you said something. So let me start with Aisha Zarakol. Aisha, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
To Aisha's virtual left, at least on my screen, is David Lake. David, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure and happy to meet with everyone to talk about international hierarchy this morning.
And last but not least, Danny Nandal. Danny, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I think this is a great group of people to talk about one of my favorite subjects, an issue which is, I think, among the most important developments in the field in the last 10 or so years, which is international hierarchy. Aisha, you've written the definitive review essay on the emergence and the nature of hierarchy studies. Do you want to start us out by maybe telling us a little bit about the topography of the study of hierarchy in international relations?
Okay, thank you. So the review essay you mentioned came out in International Organization, and David is in that book, and also, of course, featured prominently in the review essay. And what we were trying to do, it's not just my project, a number of people were involved from the very beginning. I think we convened a working group at ISA. You were there, along with others. Essentially, there was a general dissatisfaction, I think, about the way, you know, the anarchy problematic had come to define the discipline, and many people had moved on in actually their work. But this is still what we were, you know, teaching first years, and international relations equals anarchy, and so many people were trying to kind of get around that elephant in the middle of the room in their own work, but having to argue with, you know, its zombie presence, even if people had actually moved on. Maybe, I mean, you said a decade, but I think David's and others' work go back many more decades. So the review essay and the book essentially like reviews the work that's been done previously. And in the review essay, you know, we talk about the three logics of hierarchy, the logic of trade-offs, focusing on functional bargains, as exemplified, among others, by, you know, David's work, and the logic of positionality, focusing on material or social arrangements, and, you know, the roles and the positions the actors occupy. And, you know, some of my work, I think, falls under this heading. And the logic of productivity, focusing on the practical or performative ontology of hierarchies. So hierarchies producing the actors, not just the roles or the positions that they're in, which a lot of the critical, more maybe Euro type of IR falls in. That was a way of characterizing the literature as it existed. But in the book, one of my goals was to create kind of a space where different types of hierarchy research could speak to each other and could maybe inform each other and maybe take the next step. So I thought it would be better to leave these three logics behind and then work with, you know, two essential definitions of hierarchy, one the narrow definition and the other the broad definition. And narrow definition sees hierarchies as bargain solutions to problems of order. Essentially, it's an institutional understanding of hierarchy that's designed, erected deliberately. It has a lot of agency embedded in it, or assumptions of agency, whereas the broad definition of hierarchy looks more to the structural hierarchies that, you know, inform world politics. And I think most work can in IR can be classified as one or the other. And I'm happy to talk about where my recent work falls. You know, in general, I've been more on the broad side, but I'm very also interested in the narrow understandings as well. I think it really depends on your like empirical question and what you're trying to explain. It's almost like a level of analysis type of way of looking at hierarchies. I think that's not like either or, like you don't have to pick a side in the way I think of it. Depends on what you're working on, what you would focus on. And the two types of hierarchies could coexist. So instead of assuming hierarchy is institution or contracts and then anarchy is the structure, I mean, hierarchy could be the structure, but hierarchy could also be the structure, right? So it depends on what time period, what issue area you're looking at. So I guess that's enough for an opening, and I'll cede the floor to others. Yeah.
David, as Aisha mentioned, you were one of the pioneers in the quote unquote, what I call the new hierarchy studies, for lack of a better term. And you, as I remember, you were doing this work in the early to mid 90s. Is that right?
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you understand hierarchy and why you thought it was important to go that route in terms of theory and a research program.
Sure. I just set up the dimensions of the intellectual work that's being done in the field very nicely. I came to hierarchy from what she would call appropriately the narrow definition of hierarchy, particularly focusing in on hierarchy as a form of authority, the ability to make rules and enforce those rules despite resistance. The broader definition I think of is ranked orders, that any ranking is a form of hierarchy, right? Whether it's great powers, minor powers, middle powers, or status as experts and non-experts, these are ranked orders of a form of hierarchy. The narrow definition sits inside of this broader definition, how I think about it, which focuses in on a particular form of ranking that's based upon the authority, with some actors able to make and enforce rules and others receiving or following the rules. So I think of the narrow definition of hierarchy as a bit more focused in on questions of authority rather than just the ranking. Now, sometimes broad rankings like expert, non-expert do imply some authority, but it's not of the rulemaking sort, right? If you're an expert, you have the sort of, in some sense, the right to speak, right? We hear scientists, but we don't necessarily give them the authority to make rules. So that's my personal way of sorting the broader and narrow definitions. They're all related in the sense that hierarchy is always a social construct, right? Requires both or all the members of the hierarchy to have an understanding of their positions and roles and rights and responsibilities that are embedded in that hierarchy, right? So whether you're working at the broad or the narrow level, the hierarchy itself is always sort of socially constructed. It comes out of our intellectual interactions or even just the interactions themselves that produce this. Now, I cut into this in a narrow way, you know, I will have to admit, largely in response to Kenneth Waltz's theory of international politics, right? Which, you know, for all the criticism that it's received, I think we still have to recognize it was a transformative book in the discipline of IR, where he pulled anarchy to front and center. Waltz defined anarchy as the absence of authority, not the absence of status or hierarchy in the broader definition, right? In fact, his work was premised on the broader definition of hierarchy, in that there were great powers or bipolar superpowers and everybody else. So when he discussed anarchy, he was thinking of it in a very narrow form of anarchy as authority, or the absence of authority, more accurately, right? And that's a truism at the level of the international system. There's no single world government. There's no single hierarchy that dominates all of world politics. But I felt he was missing a lot by assuming that what was true of the system was also true of all of the interactions within it. And started playing with the notion that, well, maybe there are forms of authority that exist between states. Early work was on hegemony and was beginning to think about it in that context, but for reasons happy to talk about, I sort of ultimately decided that that was a bit of a blind alley, particularly the way in which the concepts of hegemony were being developed in the first generation, and turned my work much more explicitly to looking for authority where it existed and how it varied in different forms of authority between states and their interactions. And so that was the initial cut. Coming out of this Waltzian tradition led me to think about authority at the international level rather than broader definitions that would encompass things like status and other ranked orderings at the international level.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because some of the pieces I review on hierarchy treat a mission as commission. So they will take somebody's work and say, this is how Lake understands hierarchy, but it ignores X, Y, and Z, or excludes X, Y, and Z. And it's just, it's funny to hear you say yet again what I think is true, which is that there's not necessarily an exclusivity to the way that we talk about hierarchy. And I think in that sense, we need to take the Aisha's review essay and work trying to situate it that way a bit more seriously. Now, Danny, you come at this a little bit differently than everyone else. I think by the time you got to grad school, there was already like a week on hierarchy in some of the syllabuses. I don't think you were actually in the one time I taught a hierarchy course. Coming at it from that perspective, what is your impression of the hierarchy studies and how it is playing out in the field?
So I was in your hierarchy class in grad school. I think it was my favorite classes in grad school, actually, in part because it helped me sort through some of what I was trying to work through. I came at this from a very different perspective for two reasons. One is I did my undergraduate studies in Brazil, where hierarchy has always been a feature of international relations. If you study international relations in the global south, I think you understand that there is a clear hierarchy in world politics and that anarchy does not apply to everyone. The other important trend or theoretical tradition that is very present in the global south that hasn't been very present in the US in a long time is neo-Marxist and neo-structuralist approaches like world systems theory, fantasy theory, and so on. So when I was, you know, studying geography in school, people were using terms like core and periphery, and the theoretical traditions that are informing geographers and historians and sociologists who are teaching social studies, history, and geography in, you know, junior high, middle school. So when you get into undergrad and you're studying IR and you're confronted with realism and liberalism, it's clear there's something missing in this treatment of the states and the anarchy framework that other theories can supplement. So people tend to gravitate towards post-structuralism and the treatment of power. They tend to gravitate towards the English school and the treatment of stratification and great power roles as being socially constructed. They tend to gravitate towards neo-Gramscianism and all these things. So there's a lot more hierarchy type stuff happening. And then when I got to Georgetown and I was trying to work with some of the stuff, trying to integrate what I saw as these insights into different ways hierarchy play into some of the core problems that mainstream theorists have been trying to work through, I found work by David and others really helpful. And Aisha's review essay helped me kind of sort through some of this stuff. And I'm still thinking of it in similar terms to what Aisha and David laid out. I don't know if I would put it as broad and narrow, because I think the stratification angle and the super and subordination angle are not necessarily concentric circles in a Venn diagram, or I don't think of one as necessarily a subset of the other. I think they're different approaches to the question of hierarchy, but I do think that they permeate, I think, most of the scholarship, right? Hierarchy as stratification and inequality. And I agree with David that is very much present in classical and in structural realism, the differentiation between great and small powers or different tiers of powers, but also that even neorealism leaves open the door for relations of authority between great and small powers. And the last chapter of Theory of International Politics deals with the special responsibilities of great powers and how they shape international governance in ways that are basically about relations of super and subordination among the large and small. But then I also think of other ways that we can cut through this, looking at the different ontologies that different studies of hierarchy take on, some more structuralist in nature, some more relationalist, and then more atomistic social ontologies. And I think a lot of them end up making some kind of wager on one of these three general social ontologies. I also think that there's differences in how different folks coming from different theoretical and methodological traditions approach the practice of thinking about how hierarchy materializes, thinking of folks looking at this from a sort of a network perspective versus post-structuralist, post-modern perspective. Again, the neo-Marxists have a different understanding of what these stratifications are and how they manifest, not between states, but with these transnational ties between social classes. So I see a lot of different ways in which these hierarchies manifest, whether you're talking about the stratification angle or the super subordination angle. It's not clear that everyone's working with the same sort of cast of actors and cast of agents and structures in mind.
There's a lot there. I'm wondering whether David or Aisha, you have any reactions to some of those issues?
Some of the things that Danny brought up are actually somewhat missing from the hierarchy project or the field as we've developed it. Like, so for instance, both in the review essay and in the edited book, we don't have enough economic theories of stratification and hierarchy. And arguably, they, you know, that's been one area where some of these ideas have really developed.
Danny highlighted a lot of the diversity within hierarchy studies, if we want to call it that. There's no single ontological approach. There's no single empirical approach. I did an Oxford bibliography of international relations with Professor Lu Feng from Tsinghua University. We were impressed and amazed, pleasantly, at the very large number of works that are now coming out on international hierarchy. They wanted us to limit it to 80 entries in this sort of detailed annotated bibliography. I think we pushed it up to about 120, and we could easily have doubled the number of works that should have been highlighted and discussed, reflecting the range of approaches and subject matters that have been posed by colleagues working in this area. So it's sort of a growth area, but it's not yet, I would say, closed in the sense of having a well-defined empirical puzzle or a single theoretical approach or even an ontology that has been embraced by everyone. And I think that's a good thing to begin to try and bring diverse perspectives to bear on hierarchy as a focus for international politics, because it's been, in some sense, neglected so long in mainstream IR. So how this all fits together is yet to be determined. Just to pick up on a couple of things Danny said, I think there's a couple of areas where we do need, in fact, more work than what we've seen so far. One is hierarchy from, sometimes I call it hierarchy from the bottom up. Yes, there's lots of work that has been done in the Global South on the experience of hierarchy, but it's not yet integrated and meshed well with the work on hierarchy that's been done by North American and European scholars, where the nature of the discipline tends to get a little bit more traction, right? You're publishing in different journals and so on and so forth. So much of the work that is often discussed under the topic of hierarchy is written from the Global North perspective and written from the perspective of hierarchy from the top down. What hasn't been developed well or integrated into the literature is hierarchy from the bottom up, subaltern perspectives, if you will, about hierarchy. Particularly here are areas where I think there are some pressing questions is the strategies of resistance to international hierarchy, right? Authority, in the narrow definition, is always contested. Right. They may have a core agreement about what rights the ruler has and what obligations the ruled have. But in everyday politics, even well-established constitutional systems, we argue about the limits of state authority. Right. Is there a right to abortion in the United States or not? Highly contested issue, which we've argued about for decades. So at the margin, at least, if not more fundamentally, we're always contesting the limits of authority. And there's resistance, pressure and resistance on both sides of any contested issue here. We should expect the same kind of contestation going on at the global level between the rule makers and the rule takers. This is going to be part of the active process of constituting hierarchy and probing its limits and defining the rights and obligations that are understood from the bottom up, from countries, states that are more often on the rule-taking side of the equation, if you will. So that's an area that I want to encourage more people to study and integrate the literatures and those perspectives. Danny raised this, and I think it's a really important avenue for further research. The other point I would pick up on, the other area where I think the field isn't developing As fully and rapidly as I would hope, is engaging the literature on global governance and non-state forms of authority that are emerging in recent decades. Always been part, but both intellectually, academically, we've focused much more attention on this, and we've seen the growth of private governance organizations. And how that integrates into the sort of the state-to-state kinds of hierarchy that has been the focus of much of the existing literature on hierarchy is yet to be determined. I'm drawn to ecological approaches or organizational ecology to begin to think about how different species, if you will, of rulemakers interact, inhabit an ecology, and either complement one another, or in some sense compete with one another for the ability to make rules. So there's a really interesting area here where hierarchy studies can embrace and integrate with the exciting and interesting literature on global governance.
One of the points that Danny brought up that I'd like to get your feedback on has to do with the sources of interest in hierarchy. Right? I mean, obviously, we've been talking about hierarchy in many different forms for a long time, but there was definitely mobilization around that term by a bunch of researchers over the last, 20 years or so. One standard explanation for that is uniplarity, that basically people got interested in forms of vertical stratification, power, authority, what have you, because of the sense that international system wasn't working like an anarchical balance of powers said it should. And we had a fairly hierarchical relationship under a powerful hegemon, a global hegemon. But there are other stories here, it sounds like, and there are stories about the rise of interest in non-Western IR, and the incorporation of more scholars working from outside of the so-called global north. There are also some stories about the way in which theoretical pluralism might build into. There are also stories about how theoretical pluralism developing in the field made hierarchy an attractive object of analysis. And there's also, I think, a story potentially about international order in the debates we're having about international order now, having a lot to do with interest in hierarchy. And I'm just kind of curious, do you think any of those are more important as drivers, or if there's a specific kind of interface that people want to speak to?
I can start maybe, and then others can chime in. I mean, I think it's all of those things, this moment around the mobilization of hierarchy. I mean, speaking for myself personally, my initial interest, like Danny, was because, I grew up in Turkey. I was very cognizant of especially the social hierarchies and in the international order. And my early work focuses on these social hierarchies, stigmatization, the way they shape understandings of the world and responses and foreign policy choices, etc. At the same time, I have an additional interest in hierarchy. Going back to what both David and Danny said, this pluralism around the concept of hierarchy, I think that's because hierarchy is very ubiquitous, not just like now, maybe less so now, but I think historically, it's just much more common in a way. I mean, I know there's debate around this, and there's a new book by Graeber and Wengrow, The Dawn of Everything, that argues it's actually like hierarchy is a construct of modernity. I haven't read the book. I've seen the debates around it. I would argue it's the other way around. I think it's much more common to see hierarchy, and it's anarchy and balance of power that's more constructed and having to do with, European history. And, I mean, I'm not saying, I don't know exactly, I couldn't prove it, but in my experience, the concept of hierarchy is a better tool to compare across both different levels of analysis, but also different time periods. And I think that's what attracts people. It certainly attracts me because I worry that we are headed, or maybe know that we're headed into a time period that is not going to be like the 20th century. So my interest in history, partly because extrapolating from history to better theorize about what may be happening now, and hierarchy gives us those tools to like travel further back in time for comparisons, etc. And I think the same argument applies to the non-Western stuff that you mentioned. It just travels better. And then maybe for other people working in more in American IR, initially it was the unipolarity thing that you mentioned. But for all these reasons, I think people had motivations for, you know, coming to the concept. And then, you know, it's a way of making mutually intelligible. I mean, even if we don't agree on one definition, but at least we know we are like talking about things in the same family. And that like kind of broadens your horizons in a way that anarchy doesn't, or didn't for me at least.
I also agree that there are different paths into the study of hierarchy. And I think that we have, in a sense, gotten to a point where hierarchy has become commonplace in international relations discourse, and yet hasn't been adopted as a perspective by the majority of scholars working in the field. Right. So we are at a point where most people, if you press them on it, will agree, yeah, of course, there's a lot more hierarchy in the international system than, you know, standard models would suggest. And yet when you look at what's being published, especially if you look at quantitative and rational choice work, still the assumption of system under anarchy is the norm. And very few people go through the trouble of even pretending to incorporate elements of hierarchy into their theories, into the middle range theories and their empirical tests, right? This is a hobby horse of mine that knows this. Almost everything that we have in international relations, quantitative scholarship pretends that we have states under anarchy, that states formulate their foreign policies or domestic policies independently, right? That it's all independent events. There's some attempt at trying to talk about structural factors like alliances, but it's usually cast as institutional belonging as opposed to any kind of actual influence on decision making. Oh, there's a cat. I think we've gotten to a point where everybody sort of acknowledges, for these various reasons that you all point out, that hierarchy is a thing that we should probably be talking more about and theorizing more. And yet a lot of the scholarship still pretends that it's not really there, or that we can bracket it out and pretend it's not there for the sake of not having to change the way we do normal, quote unquote, normal science very, very much.
I think all of the factors that Dan pointed to matter for the development of this literature on hierarchy. The moment, if you will, when it became harder for both practical political reasons as well as intellectual reasons to ignore hierarchy as Dan, I think, correctly points out, much of the literature still does, but nonetheless, a realization among some scholars that something different happens in international relations besides anarchy. If you'll forgive a little bit of personal reflection here, you know, I published my first book on hierarchy in 1999, badly written and mismarketed as a book on American foreign policy, but it was a theory of hierarchy. Where does hierarchy come from? And that book dropped like a very small pebble in a very large pond and had almost no reaction for a number of years. And one evening, I think it was at APSA, when after a good bottle of wine and talking to some friends, and one of them mentioned, well, David, you wrote a book on something nobody thinks exists. We didn't think about hierarchy as a dependent variable. We didn't think it existed. So this is 1999, right? You know, well after the end of the Cold War, but still nobody's really beginning to think about hierarchy. What happened afterwards, and just to highlight one thing that's off Dan's list, is the Iraq War. We violated the rules and overstepped the authority that was accepted and recognized that the United States had. So if you think about the literature in the 1990s, it's all about cooperation under anarchy, neoliberal institutionalism. And we were telling a story of that's consistent with anarchy, but the incentives for countries to cooperate and act together in, well, let's say, generally positive ways. So we're able to describe the development in Europe and continuing American hegemony in a way that was consistent with the anarchy problematique. What happens in period right after the turn of the 21st century, right, is the United States begins, because of unipolarity, but it's more than just unipolarity. It's taking the freedom that unipolarity provides the United States, and it begins to violate the understanding of what a authoritative country, what a hierarchical country like the United States can and can't do. And so I always point to the spate of books. Suddenly, the United States is being described as an empire. And 20, 30, 40 books come out in the period from 2003 to 2006, thereabouts, where suddenly the United States is being recharacterized, not as a leader of the free world, but as an imperial power. That had been popular in the 60s, but nobody had written about the American empire for 30 years. Right? And now suddenly the American empire is being taken seriously. Right? And that was the opening through which I think some of the hierarchy literature began to bounce off those ideas, but also took advantage of that opening to say, now, wait a minute, the world isn't sort of cooperation under anarchy. There's something deeper going on here, which is revealed only in some sense in the out of equilibrium when the United States begins to violate or push against the limits of what had been accepted rulemaking authority by the United States. And with that opening, then the literature, I think, really flowers in this period of unipolarity. But it wasn't just unipolarity that allowed it. It was this break with the accepted rules about what the United States can and cannot do in its position of at being at the top of the hierarchy.
Yeah, if I can jump in with more personal reflections. Also, I think then, you know, since you were involved in these empire debates, I think you should offer some personal reflections as well. I think you can speak about hierarchy studies as well as any of us, so you should not just be the interviewer. Anyway, I'll just say, I mean, so while that's happening, we were talking about a little bit later, maybe, you know, a number of us who were working on social hierarchies, like Janice and Rebecca and Ann Towns. And we were saying we should just do a project on social hierarchies. We've all written about, you know, this stuff. And then we thought, why limit it to just social hierarchies? Maybe we should just gather everybody who talks about hierarchies in general. So I think, and then again, more personal reflections. You know, David was incredibly generous. He could have said, I own the concept. What you're talking about is not hierarchy. You know, how dare you? Like, but he instead very generously not only joined the conversation, but gave us, you know, institutional support and so on. So I've called him previously like the patron saint of hierarchy in IR. I think that's really, really true. So what made the moment possible is all these people coming from different corners being able to have a conversation and not being like, this is my thing and, you know, everybody else is doing it wrong. People were open to, like, most people, not everybody, but most people were open to having a conversation around that concept.
I'll dispute only the sainthood part.
If I can jump in, I think to go back to one of the causes that Dan mentioned that I think both David and Aisha referenced is the theoretical pluralism of the 90s. I think constructivism has hierarchy in its core, right? If you go back to Nikonov's idea about heteronomy as a central feature of international politics, right? Norms establishing heteronomy. If you think about Wendt and his work on informal hierarchies with Daniel Friedheim in the mid-90s. If we think back to Barry Buzan and the Cultures of Anarchy project, that has elements of what we're discussing as different structures of hierarchy and anarchy and how authoritative claim making can vary across time in systems that would otherwise be considered anarchical. Same goes for the regions and powers and the regional security complex literature of the late 1990s, right? There's a lot of hierarchy stuff happening there, even if it's often not framed as this is about hierarchy as opposed to anarchy. So I think a lot of the folks who ended up working on hierarchy studies were drawing on all these things. And again, Aisha's work on this drawing from Irving Goffman. All this stuff was coming up in the 90s and was becoming part of mainstream IR in ways that allowed for this flourishing of hierarchy studies in a variety of ways, even within North American IR, again, not to mention all the other stuff that's happening in Western Europe and Latin America and increasingly in China. So I think that's definitely something that it would have been hard to imagine hierarchy studies emerging without the sort of the perestroika of the 1990s?
I have a bunch of scattered thoughts, one of which is that, you know, I did consume David's work very closely and did draw on it when I was trying to anchor some of the work I was doing in Empire. And one of the things I thought was interesting about reading your work, David, is the way that you can tell you are looking for anything you can find that talks about hierarchy. You know, the Literature Review is very much a potpourri of different ideas. And I think that's an interesting statement on something about the field when you began this work. Now, I think it's very much the case that the debate about American empire opened the door to a lot of discussion of hierarchy or made it more plausible. But I do think that one of the lessons we didn't take away initially, which is what we should have taken away, and this is why I reference David's first wave of work on hierarchy, is that we were reaching for empire in some respects. One respect was that the US was literally forming an imperial relationship with Iraq, don't discount that, and Afghanistan. But another reason is that we didn't really have a vocabulary, I think, to talk about hierarchy outside of empire in a lot of respects. And so we had a lot of discussions that were more properly understood as being under a broader umbrella of hierarchy studies happening under the rubric of empire, and that was then collapsed into debates about what does empire mean, what kinds of empires are we talking about, what is the definitional scope, right? What's the difference between informal empire and hegemony, and so on and so forth. And so that just kind of interests me in this context. But I do want to raise another issue, which is that one of the criticisms of this work that cropped up very early, and I think still has some merit, is that there's nothing new here. The hierarchy argument is true that international relations scholars have always studied vertical stratification of one form or another, even if we talk about anarchy as an organizing principle. But that true critique also means that there is a fair amount of wheel reinvention going on. And I'm wondering how you all react to that argument that you have to have a selective forgetting of, you know, dependency theory, world systems theory, all this stuff from the 50s and 60s. The last time when we talked a lot about empire under different theoretical lenses, you have to kind of ignore the existence of a broad set of post-colonial literature. It's interesting because that, I think, criticism has teeth. And yet it's also, I think, true that hierarchy provides an opportunity for conversation that hasn't existed before. I guess I'm weighing these out as criticisms and also affirmations because I don't really know how to sort this out. And I'm curious how you all do.
I'll bite. So I think that there is a risk of presenting hierarchy as a new invention or as a discovery that erases or that runs the risk of erasing early work from scholars from the Global South, right? And I think that's what you're kind of reacting to, that when the Global North scholars discover hierarchy and find a way to mainstream it, it can become sort of almost cultural appropriation. And I think that that's a risk with a lot of IR scholarship when, you know, folks in the Global North discover things that people have been talking about elsewhere. But I do think that folks who have been working in the field have paid their respects and have acknowledged the contributions in a lot of sense from those sources. In cases where they haven't, they might not necessarily be aware of or have been exposed to because of the sociological divide and how these things are studied across global south and global north. And I think we're in a good place because by the fact that it has been mainstreamed in the global north, it allows for more productive dialogue between global south and global north where it wasn't possible before. Right, because folks in the Global North were saying anarchy, anarchy, anarchy. Folks in the Global South are saying no, 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 empire, dependency, world systems, hierarchy, and they couldn't find a common vocabulary. And I think what the new hierarchy studies have provided is this common vocabulary where we can start to make these connections and bridge this divide in productive ways. And we've seen a lot more, I think, scholars from the Global South publishing in English language journals and being able to get stuff published where the things that they're studying, right, the phenomena that they're trying to explain would have been dismissed as epiphenomenal, as secondary, right? It doesn't fall under the the category of cooperation to anarchy or the, you know, small number of big important things that Wallace was talking about. So I think we're in a good place for this kind of dialogue. And I think this wouldn't have happened without the mainstreaming of hierarchy studies and by folks like David and others.
I have a strong memory, and I think it was Bob Gilpin, about the time he was publishing War and Change in World Politics, at an APSA meeting, standing up and saying, there are no new ideas in international relations. They're only recycled every 30 years. And he was crediting E.H. Carr for most of the ideas in his work, right? Mm-hmm. So long cycle theorist that Bob was, right? He's imagining that there's a long cycle to intellectual ideas that goes about every 30 years where we have to rediscover the wheel and bring ideas back into a conversation where they had drifted out. So, I think Danny's right that we have had a period of selective forgetting, that there was a lot of interesting work being done, particularly in the 70s on dependency theory, world systems theory, and so on, which was then forgotten and rediscovered, but in very, I'd say very different language in the present literature on international hierarchy. So, we should give credit to where this past work has been very productive. But in sort of the mainstream tradition, North American IR in particular, yes, we recognized stratification, right? You can't study European diplomatic history without talking about great powers. But that was never theorized in a way, right? It was, gee, I'm going to create a dummy variable in my regression equation and call it a great power. And lo and behold, it's significant. What can we do with it now? That was the extent of the depth, right? We took these categories that diplomats themselves created and understood and in some sense sanitized them and treated them as control variables without giving a great deal of thought to what it meant, what role we expected it to play in world politics. They were descriptors rather than well-developed theoretical constructs. Yes, certainly at the level of status, we've always known that there are gradations of status within the international system. But what that meant and what it implied was never very clearly specified. This is where I think the literature on hierarchy has made some real progress in beginning different ontologies, different theoretical approaches, all of what we talked about early on in this conversation, but together they've helped us bring new insight into what these traditional categories of diplomatic relations actually mean for the practice of world politics.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. And I was just thinking, I mean, this claim of forgetting, I mean, it's certainly true. A lot of things are constantly forgotten in international relations. But that doesn't mean that I think those of us involved in bringing hierarchy back in a way, that doesn't mean we are claiming we've invented the concept. To the contrary, I mean, we were in some ways trying to like unearth that legacy of, and I said earlier, I think it's more common. Anarchy is more exceptional. That doesn't mean I think like anarchy is unimportant. I mean, I think there are certain effects of the fact that we think of, for better or worse, of international politics as anarchy. Just thinking that has effects. But hierarchy, I think, opens up, avenues to those previous elements of scholarship and other time periods, etc. And I think, I mean, I was also saying everybody was willing to join the conversation, and one group of people who were more reluctant were actually people who had been doing critical work around hierarchies, and they thought this was, I mean, not all of them obviously, but some people, some in that group thought this was like a co-optation of critical work by the mainstream, and they didn't necessarily want to participate in that. But my take on it is, it's a good thing if concepts that are critical to our understanding of the world, that help us understand the world better, if they become mainstream. And if they become too mainstream and too hegemonic, then somebody will like remind us, well, you know, it's actually, you know, hierarchy doesn't explain everything. You know, it's actually this other thing. And then, you know, that then we'll be in that cycle that David mentioned. But that's how, you know, these conversations should proceed. Yeah, I'm never very doctrinaire about like the, you know, the concepts that I use. They serve purposes. I don't know if that was a good answer, but that's my answer.
I want to get down to a couple of brass tacks issues that I think have come up. One of which we've had, you know, people have said something about this before, but we haven't really focused on, which is, how is it that forms of hierarchy that are not, say, we have a world government or we have an informal empire, how is it that those challenge the anarchy assumption the way that realists talk about it? Because realists would say, of course, we're talking about great powers versus lesser powers and the difference that makes. It's baked into the theory, but it's still an anarchy. And I think for a fair number of people working in hierarchy studies or working in this idiom, that statement doesn't quite fly. And I'm curious what you think and why you think that.
Let me begin with an empirical observation on precisely this point. So even Waltz in Theory of International Politics acknowledges that there is some hierarchy, but it's only these small peripheral powers no one cares about. The core of international relations is anarchic, and therefore let's make this simplifying assumption. That is, at least in my work, as I've tried to show, empirically wrong. Countries like Japan, West Germany during the Cold War, are part of the American hierarchy. If those aren't important states, then I don't know anything about international politics. Right? This is not simply some little island in the middle of the Pacific or in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that is subordinated in some formal or informal way to a great power. These are what we would consider to be major powers who are themselves embedded in hierarchical relationships. And so this sort of the save, the out, if you will, for traditional realist analysis, well, we care about the important countries and they're all engaged in anarchy with one another. And therefore we can safely sidestep these issues of hierarchy and authority between states. It's just wrong as an empirical fact. Beginning to think about relations between the United States and Europe after 1945, and to understand them through a lens of hierarchy brings much more nuance and understanding, at least in my view, to the nature of those relationships than you get by simply looking at them as completely sovereign, independent, autonomous billiard balls cooperating in some institutionally constructed framework. So, you know, the real test is, what does this actually tell? What does hierarchy lead us to understand about relations between important states, if you will, put that in quotation marks, right? Those important states that we wouldn't otherwise understand. And I think there's some value added there.
As you were talking, I was thinking about the argument that's playing out right now between some realists and everybody else about the Ukraine war. So you have what I see as a misguided effort to argue that Russian behavior is explicable entirely in terms of perennial ideas about great powers and geographic positions. So Ukraine needs to be a buffer state, and Russia is upset that Ukraine can't be a buffer state, or is engaged in a kind of last-ditch balancing effort against NATO. And I look at this conflict, and it seems clear to me that we're talking about assertion, you know, the reason why Ukraine is important is not reducible to security issues. It has to do with ideas about the Russian Empire. And that part of the heart of this conflict, whether it plays out over NATO or the EU, which of course was the spark for Euromaidan, is about contestation of hierarchy, of norms and order. And so for me, there's a very clear way in which if you bring different assumptions to the table, you get different answers, even to the extent that you choose different evidence. But the reason I like that example is that if you think about any relationship that should be anarchical, it's the relationship between a great power outside of the sphere of influence of another great power and that great power. And if that is misspecified without reference to things like the hierarchy created by norms and status, et cetera, then I don't know what isn't. But I don't want to cut things off. I am curious about other people's answer to this question. Danny?
So I was going to say a couple of things. I think David is right that you can't explain US-Germany and US-Japan relations during the Cold War or post-45 without reference to hierarchy. But I would say you can't explain the Cold War writ large without reference to hierarchy, to competing hierarchies and stratification between the liberal democratic world, liberal capitalist world, whatever you want to call it, and the Soviet world. The Soviet world is hierarchical, right? There's informal and informal hierarchies. Same with the Western world, and the whole idea of first, second, and third world is itself a stratification. I think it's impossible to explain any Cold War crisis without understanding that they're embedded in relations of hierarchy between within the blocks and across the blocks, right? So if you think Cuban Missile Crisis, that's a result of longstanding hierarchical relations between the United States and Cuba and the attempt of Cuba to withdraw itself from the US hierarchy and the United States' inability to let Cuba go. If you think of the Berlin crisis, it's the point at which these two hierarchical systems are clashing and the role of Berlin as sort of this linchpin. If you think of the Euro missile crisis, it's impossible to understand how and why European countries would accept those assets in Europe without understanding hierarchical relations between the US and NATO countries. I don't understand how anyone can think that you can explain the Cold War, like the core stuff that the realists are supposed to be able to explain without references to hierarchies of various sorts. With regards to Ukraine, I don't think you can explain the Ukraine war without understanding not just the attempt to reestablish Russian hierarchical relations with Eastern Europe, but also Russia's own precarious role or position within international hierarchies. And I think, again, I said this before we started recording, but I'll say this again on the record. Anyone who wants to understand this crisis shouldn't be reading Mearsheimer. They should be reading Asha's first book. I think she lays it out very, very clearly, the crisis that's happening in Russian thinking and Putin's own evolution and how he's tried to deal with the stigma of having lost the Cold War. It's all about stigma management. You listen to his speech, it's all in her book. Just go read it. It's very clearly hierarchical in his own understanding of how he's been subordinated to the West for too long and how he's trying to break out of this.
That's not an invitation for you to get in, Aisha. I don't know what is.
Thank you, Danny. That's nice of you to say. Yeah, I mean, I'll just point out that by the definitions that people who make the anarchy argument for this case, by the definitions they use, Russia is not a great power. So, I mean, the whole thing goes wrong at that point. So it's a particular, I mean, understanding that's upholding the idea of Russia as a great power. I mean, in addition to like Putin and the public that support him, they have a particular understanding of where Russia should be and where it isn't. All of those things have to do with hierarchy, well, social hierarchies in the modern international order. Yeah, I mean, of course, the anarchy stuff matters too. As I said before, it's not that it doesn't matter. What Russia has done is shocking to us because we have this idea of, you know, nation states existing in, you know, conditions of sovereign equality, which we call anarchy. And if we didn't live in a world which had that particular construct and didn't tell that particular story about how politics should be, what Putin had done wouldn't be so shocking. It would be more expected and common, and, you know, it would materially be equally damaging, but it wouldn't be, you know, this type of norm violation. So the idea of anarchy matters in that way, or something like anarchy matters in that way.
And that's an interesting issue, whether you need anarchy or whether you can posit overlapping authorities that produce ambiguity and disjuncture to get the same dynamics. This is an argument that Jacques Donnelly makes in some of his work before he decided that hierarchy was being used too much. David, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I would just add one thought to what Danny and Aisha said about Ukraine, which is, let's take the realists at their word, right, that this is all about creating a buffer state, and then think about what that actually means. Right, that the foreign policy options of Ukraine are being limited in some way, right? It's saying that Ukraine does not have the same rights as other countries to choose its relationships with the rest of the world. That's hardly realist. Realists would have a very hard time explaining what that means and how it comes about. So Russia here is developing a hierarchy over the Ukraine, not one that says you must do 1,000 things. It's simply saying you, Ukraine, are not allowed to engage in certain kinds of agreements and institutional memberships that other states elsewhere in the world are fully permitted to do. So it's a negative injunction in a way of the Ukraine's rights are abridged relative to other countries as a buffer state. Well, that strikes to the heart of hierarchy, right? If you don't have a conception of hierarchy, of one state limiting the policy options of another, and recognizing that trying to establish a relationship in which Russia has the right to so limit the Ukraine's freedom of action, that's at the core of what we mean by hierarchy. So to fully explain what's going on there, yes, you can say, well, it's a traditional great power thing doing a buffer state, but the meaning and the context and the understanding of what that involves is very much embedded in the notion of hierarchy and how we go about creating hierarchy.
Yeah, and the other element of this is how the hierarchy is created and enforced. Right, and this goes back to the question of whether hierarchy in practice is just a function of inequality capabilities. I think Waltz put it, international politics hierarchy reduces to difference in capabilities. So if you can, you do. I think realists like to go back to Thucydides, the strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. That's the only form of hierarchy that is acceptable in a realist framework, right? That you impose your will on others to the extent in modern realism, yeah. Exactly. So if you need anything other than an imbalance of power to explain a hierarchical relationship, then realism has failed you. What we have in the Russian-Ukraine relationship is clearly a situation in which there's more going on than just an imbalance of capabilities generating hierarchy or attempting to generate hierarchy, right? The tools that Russia is employing and has employed in its near abroad, it's quote unquote near abroad to establish hierarchy. It's not just about military power and coercion. It doesn't fit a realist framework for this. It's not state to state relations. There's a lot of transnational stuff happening. There's a lot of identity playing into the authority claims making, things that are not consistent with the states under anarchy model where you have the states as actors, right? It's hard to explain that what happened with Lugansk and Donetsk without understanding the role of identity, the role of transnational networks, crony capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So even if you wanted to explain it just as power politics, the repertoire of power politics that's at play is not necessarily one that fits well with the existing system of anarchy framework.
Yeah, and that raises a really interesting point, which is just because we see power politics or just because we see war, on the one hand, that doesn't mean that realism is the explanation, but even more profoundly, it doesn't mean that we have to posit anarchy to get at that explanation. And I think that's a kind of mistake we make, which is that we take behavior, which can be explained through a lot of different theories, and we say that that's owned by somebody or owned by a particular ism, and therefore it is evidence for that. One of the interesting things to me about the crisis, I know it's easy to get stuck on the event of the day, although even a profound one like this, is that Russia was demanding that the US and EU cut a deal with Russia about Ukraine's fate, which in of itself is an assertion of superordinate status in a way, in Aisha's sense, of managing stigma, trying to regain great power status through a very particular understanding of what great power status means. And I flip back to my time in the Russia-Ukraine-Eurasia office at ISD Policy and hearing from some of the architects about the reset, about the ideas behind it. One of the ideas was that you, meaning the United States, might be able to nudge Russia in the direction of seeing great power status as tied to different things. Hoping we might get a little bit more into the question of what kind of value added hierarchy brings. I mean, clearly it can bring alternative explanations, but what do we get wrong by, and we can say, well, this explanation is better, but what explanations kind of flat out run into trouble, or what kinds of models or theories misspecify something about the world really badly that we need to think about hierarchy in order to correct?
I mean, I'll quickly jump in. Others can talk about their own stuff. But for me, without, you can't talk about status and, you know, ideas of like being a great power or like this place really belongs to me, etc. Like those types of things, essentially identity constructions around the concept of great power, without talking about hierarchy. Yeah, so you missed. I mean, I don't think you can even talk about what Russia is doing now without talking about, you know, social hierarchies in the modern international order, both in the sense I've talked about them, but in the sense of, you know, this great power secondary state stuff, that's also like a particular construct that's of our time, that's really, you know, animating the way people think about it. And it's not really anchored in something that's, you know, objectively material. I mean, in some ways it is, but there is a lot of fluff around it that's constructed. And I think that those are like hierarchical social constructs that we buy into. But I mean, others have probably different answers to this question.
It's hard to say that, well, let's call it mainstream IR or the non-hierarchical versions of IR theory get things completely wrong. But the answers that they give are partial, often unexplained, and often carry hidden assumptions. Think for a moment about the various conceptions of power that are out there. So you don't necessarily want to pick on this one idea, but take the notion of soft power as a euphemism, in my view, for various forms of hierarchy. The concept gets embraced because it seems to account for some behaviors, is trying to capture some of these relationships of authority and status that are integral to the practice of world politics, but trying to capture it in a way that's consistent with the assumption of anarchy. We're still in a world of anarchy, but some countries have this strange attractiveness that allows them special rights that are not available to other countries. So that then gets cordoned off and we begin to think about, okay, well, what countries have soft power and how can China develop soft power, right? You go down that particular road when there is a richer and more connected literature available if we begin to actually think about hierarchy as containing certain rights and responsibilities that are not available to all states. Joe Nye says an awful lot of very smart things and gets some mileage out of the idea of soft power, but it's sort of hanging out there as this sort of unusual thing, very limited and not sure what to do with it and so on. But we can incorporate much of what I think he's trying to accomplish there in a much more general framework if we begin to think of this as potentially one mechanism of hierarchy, or that what he's really trying to capture with this idea is hierarchy itself. So again, you know, as the literature is developed, there's real world events out there that get sort of shoehorned into some of our standard theories that take on, I think, richer, more insightful meanings when we can explore and explicate hierarchy as an underlying relationship that's driving some of these real-world behaviors. So any positivist theory that's out there trying to actually account for what's going on in the world is going to try and capture some of these events and processes. It's the theoretical context in which we embed them and try and explore them that matters. And I think hierarchy here gives us value added rather than being a completely different form of explanation.
I'll jump in. I think, not to beat a dead horse, but the Ukraine war is a clear example in which the both the stratification approach and the supersubordination approach explain critical elements of various sorts, not just with regards to Russia and how Russia has positioned itself and has been positioned in sort of barbarian class. We all saw the Wall Street Journal piece about Russia returning to its Asian origins or whatever it is that they said. There's clear stratification happening between civilized and uncivilized, between Western and Eastern, civilized and barbarian, et cetera. That's critical to understanding not just Russia's behavior, but also the response to it. The amount of coordination and cooperation is happening among Western Europe and the North Atlantic. I think without understanding elements of super subordination, you can't understand decision-making within NATO vis-a-vis Ukraine. Just look at the Polish MiG controversy and whether Poland can actually independently supply planes to Ukraine and whether they can skirt U.S. decision-making to do so. And we say, yes, they can, but it's unclear if they can actually do that. And we're sending Kamala to Poland to figure out what they can and can't do. So there's a lot of these things happening. Can't, I don't think, understand Russia's quote unquote security concerns that Mearsham and other realists keep brandishing on without understanding security, not just as physical security, but also as ontological security. Right? And that's also about stratification and hierarchy to a large degree. So there's all these elements. Another one, and again, this is a hobby horse of mine, is that we can't understand any of these crises, the majority of these crises, understanding the role the great powers play in mediating and intervening in crises, right? Even when they're not direct participants. So the majority of crises that we have in the Cold War, and again, crisis and coercion have become one of the key dependent variables in IR security studies. And we pretend that these are all countries operating independently, and they're not. Right. And most of these crises that we're discussing are Cold War crises or crises between different participants in different blocs or countries that have superpower patrons or have deep connections with superpowers who then step in and mediate the crisis or intervene in one form or another. Have international institutions that have exercised authority in a lot of these contexts. So there's a lot of things that existing theories sort of bracket out that when you look at the cases, they're actually determinative in the outcomes. So I think that's one of the big areas in which we need to take hierarchy a lot more seriously if we want to explain some of the core stuff that mainstream IR is supposed to be able to explain.
I want to turn it over to Aisha in a second, but I have to say, and maybe this isn't very generous of me, that between network considerations, interdependencies, and hierarchy, and there's a close relationship between those two, I just have no confidence in any of the findings we have out of the bulk of directed dyad work on conflict. You know, I think a lot of really smart people have been working and doing really good work in that area without necessarily adequately interrogating the assumptions behind what they're doing. But maybe I get too taken with the idea that there's like the one neat trick that if you didn't recognize creates problems for your work. Aisha?
I was just going to underline something else that Danny brought up about how, you know, Russia got quoted as Asian, that Wall Street Journal article, which is actually from 2018, but it was making the rounds again. David, you may not have seen this, but this is referring to how Putin is like Genghis Khan, and this is supposed to be motivating, you know, his imperial project. And of course, I was interested in it because I've written a book recently on these themes. So I looked it up, but it brought to mind another type of hierarchy, which affects, you know, the way we respond to the situation. I've already mentioned, you know, social hierarchies between the West and Russia, but also, and David has worked on this in recent years, there are other like racial hierarchies, you know, there are civilization hierarchies that Danny mentioned. And I said earlier, you know, this seems shocking to us because we have this notion of anarchy and nation states, etc. And it seems like a violation of that assumption. But of course, you know, other places have been invaded in recent memory, and it didn't seem so shocking. And, you know, there's a lot of coverage of this. You know, there wasn't the same kind of eagerness to receive refugees or to help out, etc., when it's Yemen or like the Kurds or whatever. So there are certain hierarchies animating the way we think about the world and where these things are normal and then are abnormal, that also shape in a very real way international political responses to like what's acceptable and what's not. I mean, that's not to take away from the support for Ukraine. I'm completely, you know, support Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees, but also points to like why certain events, apart from the nuclear angle, why certain events provoke more outrage that has something to do with hierarchies in world politics. And we hadn't talked about it yet, so I thought I should mention it.
No, I was actually, that's terrific, because I was going to raise the question of race and IR's slow burn reckoning with a whole bunch of issues involving race, which clearly is related to understandings of hierarchy, of super subordination, of status difference, whatever you want to call it. And that's an interesting area, because you have both the practice of IR and the conditions of IR, but also the practice of knowledge about IR. And I was wondering whether any of you wanted to tackle that in particular beyond the orientalization of Vladimir Putin. You know, if you've read Patrick's book, this is exactly how segregationists are talking about the Soviet Union in the 1940s in terms of being Oriental and Mongol hordes that are threatening the West. This is implicit in Adenauer's argument that Prussia is corrupted by Eastern influences. And so it's not actually so bad if the Prussians get divided out of the nation, for example. So there is this really rearticulation of a whole bunch of things. But yeah, I want to hear if anybody has anything to say about the particular intersections with race and IR.
Well, I'll start along with Bianca Freeman and D.G. Kim, recently written an essay for the Annual Review of Political Science. I believe it's available online now. On race and IR, right? Trying to both review the very important work that's been done, especially by critical theorists on race and IR, but also point us in the direction of more positive theories of race and how and why it matters in international politics. And in that essay, we pose two faces of racism, if you will, common assumptions that are embedded in racist views. One is that countries of other races are somehow deficient, lacking in some quality that would make them sovereign equals. So that's the notion of hierarchy coming in there in the broader social sense. And in addition to being deficient and somewhat contradictory, that they're also more hostile or primitive, right? More likely to act emotionally and with violence. And so you put these two things together, and yes, you know, there's an Orientalism that you can impute to Putin, but think about all the literatures that exist in which these two faces of racism have implicit in them the whole literature on state failure. Not every state fails in quite the same way, but you know, look at the foreign policy listing of state fragility, 19 out of the 20 states are in Africa. That should tell us something about the embedded notions here of deficiency and what it means to fail. The whole responsibility to protect, it's too embedded in these notions of deficiency. And in turn, a lot of the reaction to the rise of China and anticipated reactions towards China is reflecting this second phase of imputed hostility and difference. Greater likelihood of resolving disputes with violence. And that's why, you know, in some sense, we're concerned about. So D.G. Kim, one of my co-authors in his dissertation, is showing very clearly that people who are more resentful of Asians in the United States advocate much more forceful responses to dealing with the rise of China. They're projecting a certain racial prejudice into their policy recommendations, policy understanding of how to deal with the rising China. So race as a status hierarchy, social hierarchy in Aisha's terms, I think pervades a lot of both international practice, but also a lot of our understandings of international politics without actually mentioning race or trying to develop the idea of how race explains and in some sense animates these categories that we project onto world politics. Along with the understanding of systemic racism that has come out in the United States and other countries, we're now, I hope, beginning to see how it plays a role in broader international politics.
I'll have to go soon because it's dinner time here.
I guess with that, well, why don't we just wrap it up? I think you all have been very generous of your time. I hope this has been interesting and illuminating for people listening. I know that I certainly actually learned some stuff, so that's really cool. Does anybody have some final thoughts? It might be on the subject of race. It might be on the subject of hierarchy more broadly. It might be on like what the future directions for hierarchy studies of interest might be, but you know, anybody?
Not without opening up whole cans of worms. So,
yeah, that's what I like to do. I like to drop
in respect for Aisha's dinner in my lunchtime. I will not open new cans for discussion.
I mean, I'll just say that just working on this project of, you know, hierarchy studies with scholars from very different backgrounds. In some ways, I mean, it kind of renewed. I mean, I came at international relations at a late point in my academic career. I was already almost ABD before I like took an IR course. So I came at it very sideways, and then I had to do a third exam in international relations. So I've always been somewhat loosely tied to the field and the literature, but the hierarchy project really, you know, renewed my belief that international relations can be a place we can have like substantive conversations. The concept facilitates that, I think, in a way. And my worry about like, I mean, this is like a very, you know, silly thing to say about like the war on Ukraine, you know, when there is real suffering. But one of the like disheartening aspects of it is like people on Twitter, like debating whether realism or liberalism is right. Like just, you know, going back to those, you know, old paradigm debates. And I think, you know, concepts like hierarchy, like allow us, I know we've been beating on realists in a way, but in some ways, like we work on these concepts so we can get away from those old, like stale debates. My hope is, you know, going forward, hierarchy and other similar concepts will facilitate more interesting conversations.
Danny?
Well, first of all, the fact that hierarchy and stratification as hierarchy has made its way to the mainstream, thanks to folks like David and Aisha and others, has made it easier for folks to talk about race and gender and intersectional forms of hierarchy and open up the space for scholars that had been previously delegated to secondary or third tier journals who can now participate in these conversations with the common vocabulary. I would also say that I think we are seeing more and more folks who have been resistant to hierarchy adopting that language and thinking more seriously about it. But I think we could stand to see a lot more. One of the reasons that I beat up on realism, because I think realism could and should do better, right? For exactly the reasons that we pointed out, that there's nothing in realism necessarily that is inconsistent with thinking and talking about hierarchy. And so I think we could see more realist work or realist inspired work thinking and talking more seriously about hierarchy, and people who are not necessarily identifying themselves as paradigmatic, thinking and talking more seriously about hierarchy in various forms. I think we're due for some of that.
I would conclude only by saying that I hope we have opened the door for longstanding approaches that were often consigned to the periphery of the discipline to come in and help develop a common language around hierarchy that allows us to understand and explore international politics, world politics in its full and manifest glory, good and bad.
So I just want to thank everybody again for coming on. I really appreciated your time and it was very generous of you. I know that for some of you, it's, as you said, approaching various witching hours, whether it be lunch or dinner. I hope to see you all again relatively soon in the flesh, perhaps.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I probably need to kick these cats out.
No, don't worry about that. It's they're cute things. I don't know if they're cute. I find them cute. If you listen to the podcast that we've done in the past, occasionally there'll be some line like, "I'm sorry, I can't think about this. I have a cat rubbing their butt in my face." and I think it adds a little bit of color.
Okay. Is he frozen?
Yeah, I think he just froze up. Danny, are you back?
Am I back?
Yeah, you're back.
Where did you lose me?
Pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah. And please cut out me asking to go to dinner right after David spoke profoundly about.
The stuff like that, though, that gives it a kind. There's a whole discourse about the pseudo intimacy of podcasts. There's interesting discussions about the way that podcasts have propagated disinformation. And part of the argument is that pseudo intimacy allows for that. So that's the dark side. But it's stuff like that actually gives some of these character, right, that make them kind of enduring, I think. So if you really want me to cut it, I will, but I'll see.
It was a bit of a non-sequitur. David was saying something important, but yeah.
Dinner's very important. Trust me. All right. So long.